Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Most of us think that the idea of eating right is a comparatively recent one, an idea born of better education and scientific discoveries concerning diet and good health. As our guest this week has found, however, that is not the case. People were obsessed with eating right at least 500 years ago. His name is Ken Alvala, and we will be speaking to him in just a moment. Ira Chernus will also be joining us to provide some interesting comparisons between Dwight Eisenhower's approach to the Cold War and President George Bush's war on terrorism. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on March 9, 1862, the first Battle of the Ironclads, or Iron Fortified Naval Vessels, took place in the waters off Hampton Roads, Virginia. On March 8, the Confederate Virginia, formerly known as the Merrimack, engaged two Union wooden-hulled vessels, sinking them easily. The Union sent its ironclad, the Monitor, and the next day the two vessels engaged in battle. Wooden-hulled vessels were also involved, but all eyes were on the ironclads. When the Monitor came into range, the Virginia opened fire, but to no avail. The commanding officers decided to ram the Monitor, but the Virginia was so unwieldy and hard to steer that it did little damage. After 8 hours of fighting, the Monitor had been shelled 25 times. The Virginia had received 20 hits, but none penetrated their iron shells. One cannon shot from the Virginia found its mark in the Monitor's pilot house, injuring the captain, but the Virginia finally decided to retreat to the Norfolk Navy Yard. The Battle of the Ironclads ended in a draw, but the Monitor was judged to be the superior vessel. 2 months later, the Virginia was trapped by Union forces, and rather than let it fall into enemy hands, the crew blew it up, ending that Confederate venture. The Monitor survived and became the prototype for 58 more ironclads built or begun by the Union during the Civil War.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, in death as in life, it seems, Christopher Columbus could never stay in one place. The many journeys he made post-mortem have led to confusion in rival tombs claimed by Seville and Santo Domingo, but researchers are now proposing to settle the matter, hopefully by 2006, the 500th anniversary of Columbus's death. They'd like to conduct DNA identification tests on the remains of the explorer, or those claimed to be the explorers, and of Hernando, Columbus's illegitimate son, born of a love affair with a woman in Cordoba. Whether Spanish and Dominican authorities will approve the necessary exhumations, however, remains in doubt. When Columbus died, he was laid to rest in a Franciscan monastery in Valladolid, Spain. 3 years later, he was moved to a Carthusian monastery in Seville. In 1537, Columbus's daughter-in-law relocated the remains of both the explorer and his son to a new constructed cathedral in Santo Domingo. They remained there until Spain ceded the island to France in 1795, at which point they were reinterred in Havana, Cuba. At least until Spain lost that island in the Spanish-American War in 1898, at which point the Columbuses were taken back to Seville. Well, if that wasn't confusing enough, during an excavation of the Santo Domingo Cathedral in 1877, a lead box with bones in it was unearthed, and it was inscribed with, "Illustrious and Distinguished Male, Don Cristobal Colon," Columbus's Spanish name. Did they remove the wrong remains? Is Christopher Columbus still in Santo Domingo? Stay tuned. We'll continue to follow the story.
Thank you.
They may have had different notions about it, but thanks to Cannavale, we now know that people who lived during the Renaissance were concerned about proper diet, much as we are today. Avalla is our guest this week, and he will be interviewed by Drew Burgesson, professor of history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
During the Renaissance, books on proper diet were all the rage. According to food historian Ken Albala, we all know that many of us are intensely diet and health conscious. It would probably come as a surprise, though, to learn that 500 years ago, literate Europeans were equally obsessed with eating right. Then, as now, a veritable industry of experts churned out diet books for an eager and concerned public. This plethora of diet books are the subject of Ken's first book, titled Eating Right in the Renaissance, and published in 2002 by the University of California Press. Hi, Ken, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
These authors have very different notions about what constituted a healthy body and a healthy diet. Can you describe them for our listeners?
Sure. Well, a healthy diet is a very different thing in the Renaissance than it is in the 20th century or 21st century. For the most part, they were not very interested in avoiding fat or eating less red meat and that sort of thing. And in fact, body size was not really a concern of theirs much at all, as long as someone was of an average size. But what they really were more concerned about was the qualities of the food as categorized by humoral physiology, which means that foods would be categorized as either hot or cold, dry or moist, and depending on a person's own individual constitution, they were recommended foods that would counteract it to sort of keep their humors in balance.
Could you give us an example?
Sure. Well, if you had a melancholic person who had cold and dry humors, and obviously that's sort of psychology built into that, is that they would be prone to melancholy, it would be good for them to eat warm and moistening things, things that are bright, for example, like saffron or white wine, or things that would counteract their natural tendency to melancholy.
So this is very different from our concept of nutrition today, which presumes that all human beings require the same kinds of nutrition on a daily basis.
Absolutely. Well, every single person's diet would have to be tailor-made for their own specific constitution and also for their lifestyle. Most people who got a lot of work could eat heavier and more crass foods and things that would take a very powerful digestion to break down. But there are recommendations for people who were sedentary or didn't get a lot of exercise that they should eat lighter foods, things like chicken and veal or kid, and things that wouldn't be so heavy on the digestion. And there's all sorts of other factors that were taken into account, really in a very holistic kind of medicine that we would not consider today. For example, the environment that a person lived in, how much sexual activity they got, the amount of sleep they received, the regularity of their bowel movements, things that are we don't really take into account because we assume that everything that goes into your mouth gets equally digested and you get all the nutritional value from it in a quantitative sense, where in the Renaissance they're really more concerned with qualitative sense. And there's an assumption that if food goes bad in your stomach, if it corrupts, you get no nutritional value. So it's very, very careful attention paid to the consistency of the food and the corruptibility, for example, something like peaches. Because they so easily go bad outside of your body, there's a danger that they'll corrupt also inside you.
These authors also gave advice about many other things, like how to season your food, how to cook it, how to chew it, and even the order that you ate your meal. Why were these nutritionists so concerned with what we would consider to be cuisine?
Well, cuisine really comes under the aegis of dietary medicine in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. There's an inherent logic to this, such that if a food naturally has too much of a particular quality, for example, if it's too cold, if you have something like cucumbers that are cold, adding a condiment to them, or something that just means a food you add to another food, would make it hotter. For example, if you added spices to something that's cold, you could make it a more balanced dish. Or something that was too watery, by roasting it, you could naturally correct that food. Or if something was too hot, you could temper it with things that were cold, like, for example, vinegar was considered cold and dry. It's good to put on foods that are too hot, like, let's say, pigeon, some bird like that. So, yeah, there's a culinary logic built into dietary medicine that really lasts, well, right up until the invention of haute cuisine in the 17th century.
So could you give us an example of a well-balanced meal for, let's say, a Renaissance scholar at an Italian university as compared to a peasant?
Oh, gosh, well, there's very big differences. A scholar would have to pay special attention to the digestibility of the food. Only very light things, and generally only two meals a day. That's another thing, is that they ate their big meal around 11 or sometimes 12, and that would be dinner, and their smaller meal, supper, would come around 4 or 5. The assumption is now there's a big argument over this. You know, some physicians think that the bigger meal should come at night because you're sleeping at night and there's more time to digest your food, and the sort of ambient heat withdraws internally, which you can sort of sense. You know, when you're sleeping, the heat withdraws inward. And some figure that was better for digestion. Others thought the morning meal should be bigger. But in any case, a scholar would probably eat very simply seasoned foods. Would never mix too many foods, different types of foods, in one meal. No fish and meat, or vegetables and fish. Things that wouldn't necessarily go together. And there'd be a strict order from things that were easier to digest to things that were harder. Because there was this terrible fear that if they ate something that was hard to digest and then something lighter, the lighter food would corrupt on top of the stomach before being digested. And then there's all sorts of other tricks that they would have. For example, eating cheese at the end of the meal was assumed to be a stopper that kind of kept in they don't call them gastric juices, but they basically kept in the heat and kept in the food while the stomach seethed, because their idea of digestion is really one of cooking rather than of breaking down food with acids. Now that would be, let's say, a scholar's meal. Okay, you have a light bird, one and a half glasses of wine, maybe a few olives, some bread. Naturally, it has to be an accompaniment. And sugar would go on the food, you know, rather than showing up in dessert. That's fairly typical for medieval and Renaissance cuisine. Now the peasant obviously has no rules. He eats whatever he can get his hands on. Much of his diet will consist of bread, and especially, well, by the 16th century, an increasingly large proportion of the household income would have to be spent on just basic staples. So we're talking beans and bread, and during Lent, maybe stockfish, and obviously many more vegetables. You know, wealthy people could afford meat, usually fresh, and spices and things like that. Poor people had to rely on more preserved foods, you know, cheeses and sausages and bread. And I, given a choice, I think I would be the peasants, but that's...
I think I would, too.
Yeah.
You know, in your book, you say that, you suggest that attitudes about food and nutrition were also changing, particularly in the mid-16th century. Can you describe some of those changes?
Well, I think the major shift has a lot to do with the recovery of ancient Greek authors like Galen and Hippocrates, reading them in the original Greek and translating them. And I think that the major change has to do with the fact that earlier authors, the medieval authors, depended for the most part on Arabic authorities like Avicenna and Averroes and Rhazes, authors like that. What came with the shift is that, and it has a lot to do with many other factors, but I think that's maybe the most important of them, is the shift occurs that in most medieval authors, there's an assumption that what tastes good is very good for you, hence the proliferation of sugar on all their food. And there's this idea that your stomach sort of grabs the food better and concocts it better, and it will do you better service than a food you don't like and eat anyway that's supposed to be good for you. Now, it changes in the course of the 16th century is really that there's an assumption increasingly that all bodies need some kind of correction, in that the food that's best for you is something that doesn't necessarily taste good, but it's what physicians tell you is best to counter your own humoral imbalance. And there's an assumption that everyone is imbalanced, and something that will be ideally suited for your what we would call lifestyle. So the medical literature is increasingly guilt-ridden after, say, the mid-16th century, and that lasts all the way through, well, you could argue up until the invention, up until the 19th century, when, you know, vitamins and understanding of chemical digestion comes in and things like that. But it's
really interesting because it's very similar to our contemporary language of wellness and sickness. It's almost like we've shifted back to an interest in maintaining balance as opposed to correcting imbalance.
Well, that's true. I mean, medicine, at least, is making an attempt to be more holistic nowadays, and that's something that we've certainly lost since the early modern period.
There's another element in the change in your book. You described a shift in the audience for these dietary manuals.
Sure. I think increasingly they are written for a popular audience. Now, some countries always have popular health manuals. England is the example there. And some countries will continue to make large professional tomes written in Latin for physicians who are being asked to give advice for their patients. But increasingly, through the 16th century, and this just has a lot to do with the availability of print and the cheapness of paper and things like that, and increasing literacy that comes with the Reformation, but increasingly these books are written for popular consumption, such that I think it's fair to say that with over 100 titles that come out in the 200-year period covered by my book, it's fair to say that they were pretty obsessed with their diet, certainly as much as we are. Some of these were bestsellers. So clearly, ordinary people got very interested in dieting, not necessarily to lose weight, not necessarily they didn't necessarily follow the advice that was in there, and I think that's maybe true of diet books today.
That certainly is true.
but we're fascinated with the idea that we can improve ourselves somehow by means of something so simple as changing our diet.
Another interesting element in your story was that the dietary authors start to criticize their princely audience, or what was initially a princely audience, and maybe the gluttony of their food habits.
Sure. Well, I would argue that that's probably a reflection of a divergence of several different stratifications of society that occurs in the 16th century. Now, clearly, in the Middle Ages, there were different types of people. There were, you know, monks and professional bureaucrats and lawyers and people who were connected with court. And there is a good range of society there. But I think for the most part, anyone with money aspired to the courtly culture. In the course of the Middle Ages, anyone without money obviously ate whatever they could get their hands on. What changes in the 16th century, which I think I've tried to prove, is that there's carved out a niche that is, on the one hand, uncourtly, that doesn't aspire to eat, you know, the lavish feasts and excessive spices and sugar and jumbled number of courses, and that's basically defined as gluttony by these dietary physicians. But they also want to separate themselves from lower peasant ways. So I think that carving out a unique, let's call it a food ideology, if you want, is a whole way of thinking about eating that's connected with their intellectual interests and their philosophical, sometimes their religious interests also.
And then in the mid-17th century, this fad for dietary how-to books declines. Does that mean that people actually became less interested in nutrition?
I don't know whether I would still argue that. In fact, I've written that book, which was several years ago, actually. It took a few years to get in print. But I've been working on late 17th and early 18th century medical writings, mostly about fat is what I'm writing about right now. It's a delightful topic. And I'm finding that there actually are a lot more nutritional theorists out there than I suspected. They're not popular. There's only a handful, maybe, of popular texts. There's not a big spate of them like there are in the 16th and 17th century, but there are a handful in the latter 17th century. I think for the most part, physicians were more interested in treating diseases that could make them money. So there's nutritional theorists tend to focus more on scurvy and gout and obesity and things like that.
Right.
Because there's a market for it. There's more people with money there, and they obviously want to cater to that market. So there are less dietary books, but I don't think it disappears. In fact, I've found evidence of humoral theory way into the late 18th century, where I really didn't expect to find it after there are, for example, mechanical theories of digestion and chemical theories. And, you know, by the 18th century, there's animists and vitalists and all these very interesting schools. But humoralism is still there, very interestingly.
Great. Well, thank you very much. My guest today has been Ken Albala, Associate Professor of History at the University of the Pacific and author of Eating Right in the Renaissance, published in 2002 by the University of North Carolina Press. If you are interested in reading more about the history of cuisine and nutrition, consider Ken Albala's next book, forthcoming from Greenwood Press in 2003, Food in Early Modern Europe, 1500 to 1800. Thank you.
For our site of the week, we continue on our Renaissance theme, reminded that man cannot live by bread alone, and report on an exhibit on the work of Leonardo da Vinci. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beatty.
In the upper right-hand corner of the paper, a horse rears, its muscular neck bulging, its mane flying. Just to the left, a voluptuous woman kneels with a swan's neck wrapped around her waist. And on the other side of the paper, cannonballs fly over a town's wall. The three diverse subjects on the same sheet of paper were all sketched by Leonardo da Vinci, and the sheet of paper is part of an exhibit on da Vinci at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Leonardo da Vinci, master draftsman, brings together nearly 120 works from more than 25 public and private collections in Europe and North America. They are installed chronologically, beginning with da Vinci's apprenticeship and early artistic maturity in Florence in the 1470s through his final years in France, where he died in 1519. The primary objective of this exhibition, curator Carmen Bambach explains, is that you look at the hand of Leonardo, the hand of great genius, in a very intimate way. What is deeply moving is the way that he uses the text to explain the principle, but he always turns to drawing in order to clarify the relationship. Drawing is his process of taking notes. It is his way of expressing and communicating what he is about to do. Leonardo da Vinci, master draftsman, will be at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art until the end of March.
And finally, we welcome back a Talking History regular, Ira Chernus, who offers us some points of comparison between President Eisenhower's attempts 50 years ago to convince Americans that the age of peril into which they had entered was permanent, and President Bush's more recent efforts to do the same in his war on terrorism.
50 years ago, the Eisenhower era began. When the voters chose Ike as their next president, they set the nation on a path of national insecurity that has lasted for half a century. Eisenhower urged the nation to expect the communist enemy to be around for the long haul, for 20 or 40 or even 60 years. In 1953, a White House aide wrote a secret memo spelling out the new administration's goal, to persuade all Americans to accept what he called the age of peril as the new and to all intents permanent normalcy. Eisenhower did just that, and the message stuck long after he was gone. Throughout the Cold War era, most of the U.S. public assumed that America faced an evil that would never be eradicated. Since the enemy would always loom beyond our borders, there was no way to feel secure. The permanent normalcy would be a state of national insecurity. The Bush administration's national security policy today is plunging us deeper into insecurity. President Bush called the war on terrorism a task that does not end. Vice President Cheney said, there's not going to be an end date when we're going to say, there, it's all over with. Like Eisenhower's aide, Cheney called this a new normalcy. The Bush administration ensures a continuing war with its ever-growing enemies list. Now it's no longer just terrorists or rogue states or the axis of evil. According to the recent Bush report on the National Security Strategy of the United States, we are threatened by any nation that might resist the spread of free trade or seek military strength equal to our own. The fears of the Eisenhower era came from the belief that there would always be a military competitor. The fears of the Bush era come from the opposite belief that we must never have any competitor, that the very existence of a competitor would be the main reason for feeling insecure. If so, we are condemned to eternal insecurity. No matter how big and tough you are, there's always some young challenger who will not rest until he gets a shot at the champ. Given the unilateralist swagger of the current administration, challengers will probably appear sooner rather than later. The same swagger will discourage allies from coming to our aid. Although there's vigorous debate about war in Iraq, the larger shape of the Bush security program evokes little public comment. Perhaps 50 years after Ike's victory, the national insecurity state feels like the only world we could possibly inhabit. Perhaps we've forgotten how to seek or even hope for a sense of real security. Real security does not come from dropping bombs on enemies, nor from barring our gates against them. It comes from a new vision of national humility and international cooperation that is still waiting to be born. 50 years of insecurity is enough.
You've been listening to Ira Chernus, director of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Chernus is the author of General Eisenhower, Ideology and Discourse, and Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace. Chernus's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. You can learn more about Talking History and the OAH at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
Wait until the war is over and we're both a little older. The unknown soldier.
Breakfast where the news is read. Television, children fed. Unknown soldier.